Welcome to the Startup Addict Podcast. I'm Nick Swinburne. I've been starting companies for over 20 years now. I've had some big successes, like Zappos.com, and lots of failures. Regardless of the outcome, I'm still convinced there's nothing more addicting than trying to turn ideas into reality.
Welcome to episode number 9 of the Startup Addict.
Close to double digits.
I know, almost 10. And today we're going to be talking about cash, money.
Cashola, yes. Raising cash.
Raising lots capital. Of cash. So how do you view money?
From afar.
From afar?
It's hard to say. I mean, sometimes it's a necessity. Sometimes it's something you wish you could get. And sometimes it's something that allows that fun. So I think the most, I guess it is what makes things possible. So whether it's necessities, comfort, indulgences, whatever.
Yeah.
The way the world's set up, we need money.
But from a startup perspective, though, from a company perspective.
I guess I misinterpreted. I just got reprimanded by Julio.
Listen,
unbelievable.
All right, enough of that shit.
Just no, I mean, there's a personal connection that we all have to money, obviously, but I think from a company perspective or a startup perspective, it opens doors, I think, opportunity-wise, but we're at a point in time now where you don't necessarily need it until, a certain point.
Yeah, I guess, so earned money, the more that's coming in, the better. But as far as having a big cash reserve or having a huge, marketing budget or being able to hire a bunch of people or get fancy offices, that probably has pros and cons, right? So for some industries, maybe an industry where the kind of employees you need are in super high demand, right? I guess out in Silicon Valley, a lot of tech companies, it's almost required. You've got to have that fancy office with all the amenities and the free lunches, and you got to be well funded because they have so many choices and so much of this information is used as recruiting tools that you got to be able to compete. Right.
Yeah.
So you might find yourself forced to spend money that you wouldn't otherwise, or doesn't necessarily make sense. But without it, it might slow, how quickly you can, staff up.
So when you're starting a business, how do you know how much money you need, let's say, to raise?
Well, for me, first of all, I wouldn't want to compete in one of those businesses anymore. Right. I wouldn't want anything other than the business to dictate how much I got to spend. Anything where you're okay, to start off, we got to spend a bunch of money to impress people is not the best, path. Or it's not necessarily a good or bad path. It's just that wouldn't personally interest me. But I think you at the most basic level, you look at how quickly can you be break even? How much do you need to get started? Which, for us would be how much do we need to open a location, whether it's a gym or a restaurant or a store? And then that's just for whether it's buying out an existing business, establishing a lease, getting the fixtures, getting inventory, whatever. And then how long do we think until we can be cash flow positive? So then we need, if we think we're going to lose, 20 grand a month for the first 6 months, then we need another 120,000 on top of whatever. A little bit of cushion. But I kind of like this. I mean, lately I just like the, almost like the badge of honor of as little as possible we can get it by with, right?
Yeah.
So the opposite of we got a good chance of success because we're well funded and we've got, these amenities and we picked this. It's what I learned in hindsight was there's not that many things that I would have regretted doing cheaper, right?
That's a good perspective.
And part of it is, why, right? So for example, there's two examples. So Basecamp was one where we started out doing things pretty minimally. And then because we looked around and saw, for example, a SoulCycle and thought that was a company that was doing well and that we could, we would be competing with, or, that seemed to be the way to position yourself, we overspent and probably added some features and little finishings and things that really did nothing to move the business forward or increase the chance of success. All they did was make the startup costs higher, which then has a negative effect on everything, because now the, you know, the managers in that gym, they didn't necessarily have anything to do with how much was spent on building the gym, but now it's this thing that they have to overcome. And then Nacheria, for example, was, we spent quite a bit opening that too. And that was more because when we opening it was never a thought of like, maybe there'll be a bunch of these. It was just, let's open this one location for the town we live in. And it's always wanted to do this concept, always wanted to have a restaurant. So we weren't thinking like, okay, let's make every decision keeping in mind, like, what if one day we're selling franchises and we're pitching people on one of the upsides is, look it, you can open it this cost effectively, right? So if we opened another one, we would keep that in mind. Think, okay, well, this one's great. It looks nice. And, you know, it served its purpose as a place we're, you know, proud of and our hometown and hang out. But now, because one of our future selling points should be, you don't have to spend a ton of money to open these things up, and learning that, you know, the two most important metrics are how much did it cost to open and how quickly can you pay that back. Now it's like, oh, okay. It's like a different mentality of like, huh, okay. So every dollar saved now will also tell a better story in the future.
So for those those companies, you didn't have to borrow any money. That was more self-funded.
Self-funded, which is why there was the leeway of, or maybe not as a system of checks and balances of like, is every dollar necessary?
Yeah.
It was more, can we afford every dollar versus do we need to spend every dollar? Which is a nice luxury, I guess, but like not a good, but it's a hindrance potentially to the story in the future. Mm-hmm. Because now you have to explain, well, wait, you're telling me I can open one for this much. Why did it cost you so much to open it? Well, because we went, you know, more extravagant, blah, 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 blah. We learned these lessons. And it was all true. It was, you know, it's all a learning experience. But if it could go back, you would eliminate as many costs as possible.
Yeah.
And you'd say, hey, does anyone really give a shit about, like, the tile in that? You know, could we have just taken the most basic tile? Or instead of doing...
It's a nice bathroom.
You know, yeah, granite counters. Do we need granite counters? Or do we really need a gigantic lobby for people to hang out in a gym? You know, like... Or is that just wasted space where we could have gotten away with, you know, 800 square foot of less rent to pay each month and less space to decorate? And, you know, who were we impressing with that? And did it work? And maybe that did work. You know, maybe people are like, oh, man, I want to work out this gym because
look at the size
of this lobby. I could fucking lounge afterwards in this lobby.
Have you seen the bathroom?
You know?
I'm going to Nacheria for the bathroom.
Yeah, right. I mean, bathrooms in gyms an interesting one because it's an expense. I still don't know the right answer on if the added value of having locker rooms with showers, like, you know, it's like what percent of your members actually use that? You know, and like, so say you spend, I don't know, $50,000 on adding shower or shower room, and then only, you know, I don't know, 5% of your members use it. And how much is that each month? And would you have been better off just
putting a garden hose in the back?
Yeah, garden hose in the back. And, you know, maybe you lose 5% of your revenue, but you probably don't, right? You probably lose some percentage of that 5%. And so those are all the little things that, when you can afford it and you're not like having to keep an eye on every dollar, that you make decisions that may not be the best financially for the business.
Yeah.
You're saying it's not it's a good idea to, when you're first starting off, to sort of envision the best case scenario in terms of scale and then use that as part of your overall plan when you're starting to build something up.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best plan is basically spend as little as possible and take a look at every little, which is not intuitive to me. For me, it's more like, oh, I don't want to talk about this detail and this detail and this detail. Just do it. But there's not, can't think of any situations where you would regret it, right? Like if you don't spend enough on something, and then later on you're like, I wish I would have made that a little bit nicer, you probably either are doing well and you could afford to now make it nicer, which, yeah, maybe it cost you, you know, maybe instead of, maybe you spent $2 on something, you could have spent $5. And so later on you realize you should have made it nicer, and maybe it ends up costing you $6, right? So it's more expensive, but at least you proved out whether or not you needed it. Or you, the business doesn't work, and maybe there's a rare case where the reason it didn't work was because you didn't spend enough on countertop finishing, but probably not, right? You're probably not going to regret it either way.
Yeah.
I'm not going there because of the counters.
Yeah.
Nice counters.
So, but it's, I think it's A, you know, the access to money, and B, for me at least, was not really thinking through. When I opened Basecamp and Notchery, neither one of those did I open with a vision of like, there'll be a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
I just looked at it like, oh, there'll be one. And the difference in cost was Basecamp, an existing gym space became available. So we didn't really have to do much. We just kind of moved in. The person prior had done most of the upgrades.
Yeah.
Whereas Notcheria was a grocery store. So we had to convert it and rebuild and do basically everything. And then Basecamp, after the first one, that's the path that was followed, was basically take these empty shells and pay to do everything, which now, you know, we wouldn't do. So
after Zappos, when you started companies, there was a company, I can't remember the name of it, that you actually borrowed money for.
Yeah. So there was a, for Notcheria, this was probably 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, we got this email. And so we use Square for our point of sale system. And we got this this message one day saying, hey, you have access to up to $100,000 in Square Capital.
Yeah.
And that I remember thinking like, huh. So if you would have known that in the beginning, and basically what it was, you know, Square sees our daily sales, right? So they know, they have a pretty good history of like how much money's coming in on a daily basis. So they feel pretty confident, like, all right, we'll loan you $100,000. It's a fixed interest amount. So it says, you know, you want to borrow $100,000, click here, and basically you're going to owe us $108,000, and we're going to take whatever it was, 9% of your daily sales until we pay it back. So things like that are interesting nowadays, because if you could just prove a concept one time, then it's almost like, you know, whether it's Square or other partners, they can almost like that proof of concept from that first business, you might not even have to go out and sell someone. You could just, people that, you know, a company that's aware of your sales would say, oh, here, we'll loan you some more money. And the point of it is to expand, or, you know, if you need to upgrade appliances or whatever. But that's pretty interesting, especially if you could get your startup costs to kind of match fairly closely with what amount of money you'll be able to borrow.
Yeah.
And so basically you just, yeah, we did it just for the hell of it to see if like if it really worked. And actually we did it as a form of discipline. We thought, okay, well here, let's do it. Let's just try it, because I am curious if this is really true that I just got to click a button and we get $100,000. And then B, if they're going to take 10% of our sales each day until we've paid this back, then if we can get used to that, then once we've paid it back and that stops, then in theory, we'll be used to setting aside 10% of the money. Again, this isn't something I'd suggest as like, hey, this is a great business practice. This was just more out of curiosity. I wonder if we can do it. But it was true. You got it. And then the good news was if you, it's just a fixed lump sum interest. So it's not like if it takes you 6 months to pay it back or 5 years, you still just pay that, whatever it was, $9,000. I think I've given a different dollar amount every time I've talked about it. But you still pay that lump sums, because they, you know, if you were to borrow money traditionally and you said, hey, and I guess the point of this is just there's more benefits to going out and just proving a basic business model. Because if you were just to borrow money, you said, hey, I want to borrow $100,000, and they said, okay, it's going to be 10% interest, whatever.
Yeah.
Well, that means you're going to pay $10,000 a year to borrow that $100,000. So if it takes you 5 years to pay it back, it's not, you're not paying $50,000, but you're paying whatever the total is on
the principal,
you know, so however much is left each month, right?
Yeah.
But this one was interesting because it was like, well, shit, if our sales suddenly dropped in half, that's fine. We don't, there's no penalty. It just takes us twice as long to pay it back, but we don't pay anything extra. And if our sales double, then we pay it back twice as fast.
Seems a lot easier than asking somebody for money if you could just get it on your own.
Yeah.
You know, with the proof of concept.
I was like, holy shit, I wish this was around in the past, because knowing that now, you just, you know, scrounge together whatever you got to do to get the first one going, and it's almost like your payment partner is willing to fund your expansion.
How does that change when you have a somebody that funded your business?
What do you mean?
Like, if somebody were actually to invest in your company, does that change your attitude in terms of how you operate or how you think about the business?
No, I mean, so you know, if someone invests in business, obviously you got it, they own part of the business.
Yeah.
But the hardest for me is then you got this responsibility, right? Like, you don't have the freedom to just make decisions and say, yeah, let's do it. You've got to, you know, you in theory, when you bring on a partner, you've got to go into it with the best intentions. So it's not like, oh, I'm going to get a partner, let's give me some money, but fuck it, I'm still, you know.
I'm going to ice him out.
You have to understand, like, hey, if I'm going to bring a partner in, you because you wanted a partner, whether it was just for money or advice or whatever. And so now you got to respect the fact that it's both of your business, right? Which is hard for people sometimes that start a business. They bring someone on, but they still see it as like their business that this person got added to. And really, no, now it's both of your business or everyone's business. So that's a challenge if you, it's good and bad. It's like everything, I think. It's good and bad. If you want to be able to just make impulse decisions or quick decisions or go whatever direction you want, whenever you want, then you really shouldn't. You should try as hard as possible not to bring any partners on, or at least set their expectations of like, hey, I'm going to kind of do whatever the fuck I want. And do you still want to invest?
Yeah.
And maybe you have a business that's so, you know, it's a lot of the ones you read about, right? Like, I guess Facebook's the biggest example, right? Where Mark Zuckerberg keeps, and the Snapchat guy did it too, where they just keep changing the voting rights so that the more money and more money and more shareholders, but they still have complete control of whatever it is they want to do. But in those cases, people are saying, oh man, this is like, I believe in you or whatever, or I just want access to all this, the money that you're going to kick off. So they don't even care. They're willing to accept those terms. Or you've got to say, no, I mean, I understand things are going to change. Like, just change your own behavior and be like, this is not my company anymore.
Yeah.
Which is hard. So.
I think it goes back to, I think you talked about it some during episode, you got a little bit, episode one for Zappos. Because I think I remember you talking about how you felt emotionally having to, when you have friends and family who are giving you money, and how that changes the pressure and the responsibility that you feel, because now you're, you know, oh shoot, now these people are trusting me with their money and with my idea.
Yeah, I think either way, whether it's friends, family, someone you're, you know, familiar with, or just someone you just met who's quote unquote just an investor, they both have their own pros and cons, which are unique to each person, right? Like with friends and family, it might be an easier to approach them because, you know, obviously they know you. So hopefully, you know, you'd have a pretty good sense of like, you know, this friend or this family member thinks I'm a complete idiot, so I'm not gonna approach them. But you know, the ones where you think, hey, this person probably thinks that I know what I'm doing, and they seem, I'd enjoy having them as a partner, blah 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 blah. But there's another the whole complication there of you have a pre-existing relationship which is now gonna get potentially strained, or mm-hmm. You know, everyone goes in thinking it's only gonna enhance things, but you always have to assume there's the downside. I mean, I when I borrowed money from my parents for the sports art business when I was in college, and then that business didn't work out because I, you know, messed up basically paying two Lakers, Nick Van Exel and Eddie Jones, to autograph these posters. And I'd probably overextended myself with how many I was going to make, and I'd overextended myself from having Jason Kidd sign a few to having these guys sign 500 each. And I'd overextended myself by having my friend as the artist, and when he'd killed it on all the ones before, but all of a sudden this one, it wasn't the right look and feel for sports lithograph collectors. But again, I was friends with him, so I didn't want to offend him. And then you know, my parents had invested, and all of a sudden I lost that money, and I felt like, you know, it should have been, that's my parents, you know, they'll understand. But then there was part of it was like, I just lost my parents' money, like, fuck, you know, like, it almost felt worse. Like, I felt so guilty for so long. Or, you know, Zappos worked out well, but that was and that felt great, right? Because that was some friends from college and friends from high school and friends of friends and random people that it was like, wow, that was awesome that, like, this worked out. And it's even better because it's people that I've known for a long time that were rewarded for believing it in the first place.
If I remember correctly, there was a percentage of those people, those early investors, who were essentially just offering you the money and being like, yeah, I want to help you here.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you actually had to go and ask because you were in a position of real necessity to see an idea grow?
Well, not with anyone I knew. So, I mean, obviously the sports art, mm-hmm. I asked because I decided that I needed, you know, I could afford to get 50 things autographed myself, but I couldn't afford to get 500 autographed by two people. So I had to ask for money for that, and that didn't work. You know, Zappos, I had to ask, but mostly I was asking people that I was introduced to, and then I had friends that were like, hey, pitch some money in, like, mm-hmm. how much would I have to pitch in, right? After Zappos, when I left Zappos to start Stagger, which is Style and Graphics, which was the apparel customization company, that one I was going to fund myself. But then Tony from Zappos and Dr. Vic, who was my chiropractor who had invested in Zappos and then went to work at Zappos, they were both like, hey, if you're taking money, like, we'll put money in. And so that was one where I thought, oh, fuck it. Yeah. All right, cool. Like, A, it's a good sign for when I'm trying to raise money in the future that, you know, people I worked with at Zappos and who invested in Zappos and Tony, like, well, actually both of them, Tony and Dr. Vic, they're both still willing to invest, right? Especially because there's, like, you know, people are like, I knew that people were like, oh, my, you know, why is he leaving? And there's these rumors. And it's like, part of that was around like, oh, me and Tony must have gotten some big fight. Yet the reality is he's saying, hey, I'll invest in the next company if you want. Like, if not, no big deal. And I was like, okay, sure. Now, where that complicated it was, that company, after a while, I realized wasn't working as I'd planned. Like, to succeed, it had to become a different kind of company that I wanted. I wanted it to be like this design creative company. And really the opportunity was like a manufacturing, like, you better have every focus on the details and focus on these processes, which wasn't what I wanted to do or what I was good at. But it made it harder to say, this isn't working, I'm not going to do this, because I had now had people's money that I knew. Yeah. And so it was like, shit, I don't want to tell Tony and Dr. Vic and that I've lost their money. I don't remember if my parents put money in that one. But anyways, but I didn't want to tell them that. Yeah. So instead, I end up funneling more and more of my own money in, trying to make it work or find a way around that.
Yeah.
So my experience has always kind of been, if you can avoid taking money, then always avoid it.
Yeah.
And if you're going to take money, you know, make sure A, it's everyone understands like how the process is going to work as far as like making decisions is a big one. Two, make sure I went from A to two. B, make sure it's someone that you're going to enjoy talking to. C, make sure everyone's expectations of how long or slow this process might be are the same.
Yeah. Double breasted suit. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. But, you know, obviously, but if you don't have your own capital to put into it, then there's only two ways to do it. One is get money from someone else. And two is just start in a way that doesn't require any money and slowly, like, one step at a time. And then either get to the point where you're generating money or the business is able to grow on its own. Or two, you've put yourself in a position where the company or the idea is more proven. So you've reduced the risk of like bringing on investors and then realizing that your hypothesis was not correct or there was going to be some issues came up, right? So the longer you can hold, it's always the less money you can take, the better. And the longer you can hold out, the better. The exception, being if it's something where you're like, this is an idea, the window is short, and I have to do this now and as fast as possible, otherwise someone else will do it.
Like if you have some sort of proprietary thing or if your IP is, you know, someone else will discover it and you got to get to market first.
Yeah, I mean, if all of a sudden someone said like, hey, we're going to fucking clear out every drive-through in the country and it's a fucking free-for-all, whoever pays, you know, $100,000 a piece gets every drive-through spot and it's guaranteed to make, you know, be a billion-dollar company in 5 years, then you're probably like, shit, we better...
We need money now.
If we don't get all these drive-thrus, this is the worst example. I don't know. I thought it was... I guess I must be hungry.
I thought he was going to go like the speed quarter route. Like someone just bought out every single warehouse and turned it into an arena.
We're selling all drive-thrus.
I was thinking of like, what would you have to do really fast? And so I think I thought of fast food. But then I must be... But then...
it's a logical step.
You know, then in that scenario, you're like, if I don't do this, someone else will, and I... 1,000% believe that this is an opportunity, then yeah, you'd want to raise as much as possible, and you wouldn't, which then ties into, you've got to be realistic about, you know, the other side as well. Like if you're gonna raise money, you're not raising it from a robot. I mean, I guess you might be occasionally in essence from a bank, but like you have to, in a good relationship, you have to think of both sides, right? So you could say, oh, I'm gonna. Dennis wants to invest. I'm gonna fucking beat him up on this valuation because I want Dennis to get as little as possible of this company for as much money as possible. And that's great if it all works out for, well, if it becomes some gigantic company, then everyone's happy.
Yeah.
And it's great for, you know, the guy raising the money in theory, but really it's not because. You might have gained a little bit now, but now you've got an investor who's going to put a lot more pressure on you because the expectations and the results that you need to get him a return are much greater. Where you might have been better off potentially down the line when you come to a fork in the road if you'd, you know, been a little more thought of both sides and said, let's think of a valuation that's fair and also gives us a little leeway. Because if you have a valuation where the only way Dennis is going to make any money is if it's $1 billion company, and then
that's pretty good odds. I take that odd.
Well, you don't want that odd as an investor. The only way you make money is if it's $1 billion company.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah, you don't want that. Yeah.
Okay. So, right. Goons, baby. Yeah. Crooks and goons.
Baby. So say, you know, a couple years down the line, you realize, shit, okay, because of X, Y, and Z, this is not going to be $1 billion company. But this could be a really cool $100 million company. Except, you beat up Dennis so bad.
All I get is two t-shirts.
That, yeah. It's like, he invested at a $200 million valuation when he could have invested at a $20 million valuation. So now instead of like you having an investor and a partner that's like stoked on, yeah, let's do this $100 million company, you've got someone saying that's bullshit. You know, you're not going to follow that $100 million path because I've already invested at $200 million. In fact, it happened to Zappos, right? So we all had different ideas what we wanted, right? But one of the ideas was, can we go public? And Tony really wanted to not have any investors kind of dictating anything, right? At this point, I was the opposite. I was like, I want to go on to the next thing. I'm looking at this financially. He's looking at it more like, I just kind of want to control this thing for my whole life. So if I go public, then I can keep control. We can, you know, keep control of it. We don't have to sell the company, right? But the problem was when Sequoia had invested, they invested, I think, $45 million, and they got less than 10% of the company. So the good news was, it was a shitload of money at the time for a very small percentage. But the reason they gave us that was because they put a liquidation preference in, which meant they were guaranteed, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was like 2.6 times their money. So no matter what the company was sold for, they got their money back plus 2.5 times. So they put $45 million in. That meant that any sale, they were going to get their 45, plus 2 times 45 is 90, so that's 135, plus the 0.5 or 0.6. So it's just for the hell of it, let's say it was 0.5, so it's 22. So no matter what, they were going to get $157 million before anyone else got anything, right? So if you, in order for that to happen based on their equity stake, it had to be over a certain amount, right? So you're thinking, okay, well, we have to sell this. In order for them to get, and I, some of my math is wrong on this, A, in how I'm remembering it, and B, as I'm calculating it.
Calculating my brain.
But if they're guaranteed $150 million, and they, let's just make it easy numbers. They're guaranteed $150 million, and they own 10% of the company. Then the only point it makes sense for everyone else to sell the company is if we can get $1.5 billion. Because if we sell it for $500 million, because say you own half the company, then, okay, and Sequoia owns 10%. When you sell it for $1.5 billion, they get their $150 million. Whoever owns half the company still gets their $750 million. But if the company needs to be sold for $500 million, Sequoia still gets their $150 million, which only leaves $350 million. So now the person at half gets $175 million, which is a huge difference,
yeah,
right? But they don't have, they only have upside. They can never get less than $150 million, but they could get, you know, if the company sells for $3 billion, they're still going to get their 10%. So they get basically whatever's higher. 2.5 times what they put in, or 10% of the company.
That's a good deal.
Yeah. And then in this situation, where it was interesting was because the reason they couldn't go public was because they were concerned that, yeah, when you, on the day that you go public, or when the shares take a pop, it'll probably be worth more than our liquidation preference. So maybe the company will be worth $1.5 billion. But what if during that 6-month lockup, where sometimes when companies go public, shareholders aren't allowed to sell for 6 months or whatever that period of time is. If the company all of a sudden is worth $750 million, we'll have had to have already waived our liquidation preference. So at that point, we'll only get $75 million, which is only $30 million more than we put in. So there was those complications. So in theory, if the ultimate goal was to take the company public, we would have been better off saying, hey, you guys can have 20% of the company for $45 million, because then you would, and no liquidation preference, right? Because then all your options would have been open as far as maintaining control of the company. It doesn't mean it would have been better off dollar-wise, but if maintaining control of the company was good, at least you could make any decision, whether it's sell, go public, stay private, without having to worry about like how much they would make on their money. But it's tricky. There's no right or wrong, because at the same time, you know, you needed that money, and without that money, you wouldn't have grown, and blah, blah, blah. And in a perfect world, it never gets to that point, right? It's never, the relationship doesn't deteriorate where the investor, in Zappos' case, the investors lost a little bit of faith in the management team. The management team resented the board of directors for not letting them just kind of do whatever they wanted. And so it deteriorated a little bit. But say none of that would have happened, and the company would have just been growing and exceeded all their valuations, and everyone would have been happy, then it could have stayed in control forever, and it could have been $10 billion public company. But it's more like you got to think about all those what ifs. Like, what if this goes wrong, or what if this goes well? How is that going to affect all of us? I sometimes err on the other side, so I'm sometimes more I'm more guilty of being less worried about like hoarding all the money or hoarding all the equity. I'm more thinking like, well, why would that person do it? Why wouldn't they do it? Like, what, you know, is it exciting enough for that person, or are they getting enough, or what are they thinking? So there's that middle ground of like being responsible for yourself and doing what's best for yourself and what's, you know, best for the other person. Now, obviously, look, if it's fucking Square, you're just clicking a button, then you could give a shit what they think.
Yeah.
Right. In that case, they've put themselves out there. Like, we don't care. We don't want you to care about what we think.
Yeah, that's the difference between being approached with money as opposed to going out and seeking it on your own.
Yeah. And when people are involved, it's just different. It's subjective. Like, okay, if it's just based on a formula, and someone says, hey, we've seen your daily transactions, so we're going to give you we're willing to give you $100,000 and you pay us back with 9% of your sales. It's like, if you know in your head, all right, well, tomorrow our sales are about to fall off a fucking cliff, you know, and yeah. they're going to go from $10,000 a day to $1,000 a day. So you're instead of getting $1,000 a day square, you're only going to get $100 a day. I don't think that's your obligation to tell them, because they're saying, hey, we're based on what's happened to date, we're willing to do this for you. We don't want to talk about it. We just want you to click this fucking button. Right? I don't think that's ethically, I think that's fine. Say, yeah. hey, what do you want me to do? But so, if there was a person involved, then I think it's disingenuous to be like, no, things are going great. Yeah, we want to invest. But look at our sales yesterday, were $10,000 and blah, 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 when you know that the next day it's going to be $1,000.
Yeah.
So, not that that's the scenario that anyone asked about, but I thought I'd go into great depth about that one.
Well, it sounds like the two options you really have is, if you don't ask for money, if you take your business and you actually make a proof of concept to where it actually can generate some income, then it'll be a lot easier to actually yeah. go out and just get money on your own. People just see the results.
Well, they do ask like those sort of qualifying questions on shows like Shark Tank and shit like that, right? Or yeah. you know, you get a very basic, you know, lesson on valuations and dilution and all that stuff on shows like that.
Yeah. And part of it is like, you get, so, you know, most times to start a business, you need X amount of money no matter what. Even if you were to bootstrap it, like if you wanted to open, instead of opening a gym, you're going to open a, you know, start personal training. You still got to buy some equipment. You still got to yeah. rent some space. So there's still going to be some money that you either have to put in yourself or you might need to raise. A lot of times it's the business model though. You look at it and you're like, I need this much money, or I want to spend this much money on X. And then you realize if you have access to that money, you might just continue on that path. But if you don't have access to that money, you might realize you're kind of forced to, I don't have to do it that way. Like, what I always think is crazy, which I've been guilty of too, is coming up with an idea, creating a business model, and then thinking or saying out loud, it doesn't really work. Like, it doesn't really pan out. I think we should do it anyway, because we'll figure it out. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But, like, that's probably a luxury of money. Whereas the reality is, like, no, there's nothing wrong with the idea. It's just you have this fucking business model that doesn't ever make sense. Well, sometimes that might work, right? Like, I guess in theory, Jim's always talking about Uber's going to fucking take over the world one day with these self-driving cars. And yeah. so they can afford to... Or Amazon, right? They can afford to keep losing money because they know that they can move this lever whenever they want. And at Zappos, we would always say the same story. We're losing money, but we're like, hey, all we got to do is stop the free overnight shipping and we can be profitable. But the challenge is, when it came down to it, if someone said, well, if you guys want to be profitable, then just stop the overnight shipping. It's like, yeah, but then we think we might lose all our sales. So then our sales would go, you know, so it's like this yeah. imaginary lever or lever, whatever the word is. Even with gyms, you know, it was like, you think, okay, well, the gyms are generating a bunch of money. So, okay, so as an investor, how am I going to get my money back? Well, you could take a percent of sales out every month, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but if you do that, then can we keep growing? Like, I remember being in a meeting, there was a hedge fund that was interested in investing in Basecamp. And they were, I can't remember what model they were trying to convince us, sell us on. It was like a combined model of, you'd have corporate owned gyms and you'd have franchises or something. And they started talking about the bigger names in the industry. And I remember being like, the only thing I don't understand is, how do you not keep betting the farm, right? Like, if I've put X amount of money in, my plan is I put X amount of money in, I'd like to start getting that back. I didn't intend to put that much money in.
Yeah.
B, is my company, so I feel like I should be able to take money out, but there's trade-offs, because if I take money out to pay myself back or to pay any investor back, then the company can't use that money to grow, right? So they were like, oh, you know, it's pretty, they're like, no one's actually figured out in corporate-owned boutique fitness how to pull it off. Even the most famous names in that space, they're kind of stuck, because they can either stop, they've raised money based on expectations, so they have to keep growing, because people have invested on the understanding that they'll keep growing and their valuation will go up. But they also can never, like, and so they're generating all this money, which could be going back to the investors. But if they start giving it back to the investors, then they stop growing. So they basically are taking all the money they're making and they're using that to open another gym and another gym and another gym and another gym. And the idea is one day, what they're selling the investors on is, hey, one day we won't want to open any more gyms, right? So say we have 5 gyms and we're generating enough money to open a new gym every 3 months, right? Then at the end of the year, we'll have 9 gyms and, you know, whatever. Now we'll have 9 gyms. We can open a new gym every month and a half. And, you know, it just keeps growing and growing and growing. And one day we'll have 100 gyms. And in theory, once we have 100 gyms, we'll be generating whatever, you know, $2 million a month or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So when we're generating $2 million a month, we'll be worth X. But then when we get to 100, you're probably going to be like, well, now we need to have 500 gyms, so it always just goes back in.
So how do you stop that? Because it was like a cycle where it just keeps going. Like,
I don't want to do that at all.
You invest and you're like, well, we got to keep going.
I mean, it's just it's a kind of a personal choice, right? We would discuss it all the time at Basecamp. Like, it kind of fluctuates. Sometimes you're like, oh, I want to have, wait. Like, if we could just chill out with 5 gyms that are all making good money, like, this is pretty cool. But it's that balance of like, well, that'd be good for me, right? Because I could start pulling out money and repaying all the money that I've put in. But if you maybe the staff's like, wait, but that's not that fun for me. I want there to be 20 gyms and 50 gyms and 100 gyms. And either A, because I want to grow into a bigger role, or I want to develop more people. And like, if we only open one gym a year, there's not enough room for each manager to become a regional manager. And if there's no room for a manager to become a regional manager, then there's no room for an assistant manager to become a manager. And there's no room for, you know, a new hire to become an assistant manager. So like, the whole progression changes, right? So in that model, you'd have to flip it more to like, okay, so there's not going to be as much advancement. We're not going to be bringing in as many people. So we need to shift to a model where people, you know, are sharing in the profits or something, so they can feel like there's a reason for them to stay for 10 years versus like the company stopped growing. And then at the same time, it's like, yeah, but what about the investors, right? The investor want to know, like, well, I put all this money in. I didn't put it in so it would just
be forever.
It would just be forever, right? Yeah. And some investors are like, oh, I don't even care about that because, yeah, if you can get to 50 gyms, then your company will be worth X, and then you could sell it based on its potential for this, and that's how I'll make my money back.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's probably a middle approach where it's like, all right, well, here, let's take half the money and pay it back and use half the money to expand. And but it doesn't always have to be because there's investors or owners. It's always that tug of war between like investors and management and staff, and like everyone has that what's in their own life is the only thing that should be the most important thing to them, right?
Yeah.
Nobody's career. Nobody should be like, my career is not as important as my manager's career or the owner of the company's career, right? Like, their career, their situation should be more important to them than anything else. But sometimes it can't all
line up
exactly, yeah. Right? So then it has to just be like, everyone has to understand like what they're working towards, or it's the same with anything, right? It's the same with staffing, right? I mean, we have situations all the time where it's like, oh, this person should make more money. Why? Because they've been here this long. Are they doing anything different today than they were 2 years ago? No. You know, is the performance better today than it was 2 years ago? No. But they've been here this long. They should get more money. I totally understand that from an employee perspective.
Yeah.
But then what about the business? Like, how does the business, if the business is basically the same, how does the business support people doing the same thing at higher pay? It means that probably it's not always a trade-off, right? So if the business, say you have a business that's doing $100,000 in sales and making $25,000 in profit, and then the business grows 10%. So now the business is doing $110,000 in sales. You're thinking, oh, sweet. Well, except everyone wants, you know, 15% more to stay, or to keep running the business. And it's like, okay. So you had a business that was doing, you know, 100. My math may not end up on this fucking scenario. We'll see what happens. So they're doing 100, right? And its expenses are 75. And all of a sudden, the expenses go up 15%. So they go up 15% about to about 15% of 75 is like 11.
Yeah.
So they go up to like 87. But the company's making 110 now. Okay, but now the company at 100 was making $25,000 a month. And now at 110, it's making $23,000 a month. So which one's better? You know, like the staff's in a better position because they're making more money. The company's less profitable, but its top line numbers are higher. So if you're someone's basing it on that and saying, hey, we can prove the model that like, so there's just, and none of them are right or wrong, right? There's like some businesses where it's like, oh, the top line number is growing and we can always say, hey, well, I know our profit went down, but that's because of XYZ. But if you were to open a new one, they wouldn't be making as much. But then at the same time, if it's like the ability to pay an investor back, now you have less of an ability to pay an investor back. Or if you're in an industry where it's only judged on profit, now you've got happier employees, but a company that's worth less. So it's always like, you know,
it's like a juggling act.
It's a juggling act. And the most, all you can really do is in any of these positions, be aware of everyone else's position, right? Because you understand the repercussions of not being aware of that. Like you might say, no, this business pays this much for this person. And then if you make that rule, you have to understand what that's not going to align with that person's life. So now you're going to have to be a business that goes through those people, right? And says, hey, let's take each other to here. And I totally understand when you get to here, you're going to move on to something more lucrative for yourself. And that's, but you know, hopefully by the time you get to that point, we both understand that like you contributed to the company's success and we contributed to your growth, blah, 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 blah. Now that would be best case scenario, right?
Yeah.
A more common scenario would be people going like, what the fuck? I've been here for this long. I don't have a raise. Well, that's because this job hasn't changed and that job pays X. And there's a balance. And sometimes people are more important than profits. Sometimes profits are more important than people for the good of the business.
Yeah.
So we got off track a little bit, but it's the same thing, I think, anytime money's involved.
Yeah.
You know, it's an investor or an employee or a existing owner, whatever. They all want, rightfully so, what's most lucrative for them. And there's very few scenarios where it can be most lucrative for everyone. Now, you could probably find a scenario where it's, you know, a little bit below maximum for everyone. But if everyone's trying to optimize it, it's impossible to make it for the long run happen for everyone. But it's interesting. But I think, you know, the most important thing is whether it's investor or employee, just being open about these things and explaining these things. And not getting in a situation where you're like with an investor where you kind of resent the investor because you would do this otherwise, but now you have to ask their permission, or an employee being like, my employer is holding me back, when really it's, no, this is the job in the company. Or a company saying, hey, this employee is holding me back because they want more money, which will mess up my margins, where it's like, of course they want more money. Why wouldn't, they should want more money. You know, like it's that weird balance. But it's hard for everyone, especially investors and people taking the money, not to have a bias when like either thinking about it in the beginning or looking back on it. But it's all comes down to the simple reason of everyone wants what's best for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So bunch of selfish fucking people we are. I tell you, it's crazy. That's why Julio wants notes. It's an outrageous request, right? Just because last
give
week,
me notes, damn it.
Last week he was complaining that he got no notes. Now, we had to print
all I wanted him was emailed and or texted to me so I can.
In fact, the notes we gave him, he doesn't even have on the table right now.
I do. Look, they're right here. I just have them positioned.
All propped up.
Fancy.
Based on the notes.
So, anyways, Shark Tank. You brought up Shark Tank, and
is that how you want people to pitch ideas to you?
No, but so here's what I think Shark Tank is good for. I think Shark Tank is good for people to understand the kinds of questions they're going to get asked. And it's good for them to see like the difference between the people that have thought through what they might get asked, and also thought through the perspective of the investor and how those situations tend to play out versus the people that are, you know, came in unprepared or are arguing about something that's like, you know, they're nickel and diming basically, where it's like, sometimes you're, I mean, I'm sitting there watching going, dude, what are you, like,
what are you doing?
If you turn around and walk out of that room, what the fuck are you going to do? I mean, they're still going to get a bump from being on the show, but
yeah,
versus what you could get from these people. And then there's other ones where you're like, oh, the sharks are circling and like, you don't know what you have. You shouldn't, you know, give up to X. And I think the whole show is confusing because from what I understand, even just by going on the show, ABC or whatever channel it's on, they get a part of your company. So really? If you just agree to go on the show, they get some percentage of your company.
Something to think about with Crooks and Goons.
Yeah, whether you get a deal, whether you get a deal or not. And there's also some, you know, I think a high percentage of those deals don't even, it's all based, because they don't have enough time to do all their diligence and go through all the numbers. So they've probably been given a packet beforehand. And then they have to double check after the show. Is everything you represented true?
I've heard of that.
And then they can both still back out. Like, so you always hear the horror stories. But I think it's, the biggest takeaway I have from it is like, I just watch it and go, could I answer this question? Could I answer this question? Could I answer this question? And even if I don't want an investor or anything, I'm like, if I can't answer that question, why? Is it because I haven't spent enough time thinking about the answer? Or is it because I don't want to know the answer? Right? Because that might kill the idea. And I also think it's a good balance of, it does, I think, give a good perspective of being realistic about what an investor is going to want versus the stories you hear in, you know, about Silicon Valley and these, you know, billion-dollar companies and these best-case scenarios. And it's just a more realistic scenario of, like, probably, of, like, what an investor is going to expect, especially for a smaller business. Because a lot of these businesses, they're not, they don't have the potential to be billion-dollar ideas and have these huge IPOs. And so the expectations change. You know, the smaller the potential of your business, the more equity you're going to have to give up, obviously, for the same amount of money. And the more you might have to do, like, start paying out of profits, right? People are willing to just, hey, let's just let it ride, and I don't want any money, and I just, let's just make this thing into a big sale or a big IPO. But if you got a business where it's more like, this is just a cash flow business and it's going to slowly grow, then people are going to expect some kind of dividend or payout, you know, or some share of the profits as it comes. So you can't raise money based on that and then into your business plan write out that you're going to spend 100%, you know, reinvest 100% of the profits into your business without asking the investors, are you guys okay with not getting any money back until the company gets sold? And it's, you know, there's some things, it's just a matter of thinking it through. Like, some people might be like, you're going to get your, you know, you're going to get your money back if we sell the company. And then the investor could say, when's realistic expectation? Like, how many years in do you think the company will be sold? And how much more money will you need before then? Because not only is the, you know, say you have, I'm going to give you 20% of my company for $1 million. But in order to get to the point where I can sell it, I know I'm going to need another $10 million. And so we're both going to get diluted when I go raise the next round, right? But I don't think it's even that uncommon for an investor to be like, okay, I'm willing to go for that. When do you think we'll, according to your plan, when will the company be ready for sale? And the owner being like, I don't ever want to sell the company. And then being confused why the investors are like, well, then why would I invest if you're never going to sell the company and I'm never going to get any money out? But again, I think I'm more interested now in the non, you know, bet it all on scale tech companies. And so I think it's just different model in the, with the smaller business, and just kind of hopefully keep turning one into two and two into three and three into four and four into five. You know, ultimately the best advice I ever got was in the beginning of Zappos, which was just do it, just keep the company moving forward, you know, do what you got to do. Like if you need to raise $100,000, tell them what you'd be willing to give up for $100,000, meet with everyone who might be willing to give you $100,000. And if the best offer is half of what you were hoping for, what are your options? Stop because you couldn't get what you wanted, or all right, fine. I guess that's the best offer out there. I'll just keep moving forward. And I'll have, you know, like I deleted more than I wanted to, but I'll just have to be better to make it up later. Blah, 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 blah. It's funny. At the end of these things, I always feel like I just ranted and rambled.
No, I'm looking at the notes. You're hitting everything that we're supposed to.
So, and as far as stress, I don't think it's either way. I think, you know, business is stressful. And so there's pros and cons for doing it on your own and doing it with partners. And the trade-off is more just personal preference and what you need. Some people enjoy the, hey, I'd be glad to give up part of the ownership for the ability to go through this process with someone else, or, you know, use someone else's money instead of my own, or accelerate this process. And some people are like, eh, I'd just rather take a slow path by myself, have control, grow slowly. And sometimes it's more lucrative to do that, right? Like if you can, you could take more money out and you won't be forced to hire as many people to grow as fast. You know, the biggest thing about taking investors is they have their expectations. Whatever you sold mm-hmm. them on, they're going to assume that that's the plan.
Yeah.
So you can't sell them on the plan of like, hey, we're going to do X, Y, Z, and we're going to turn this thing into a, you know, $50 million company. And then after you take their money, be like, you know what? I was thinking about it. And if we get to be a $50 million company, I could make just as much money in salary at a $5 million company. It'll just be a lot less stressful on me as a CEO. So, you know, it's like, no, that wasn't the vision you sold. So if you want to be able to change your mind and do whatever you want, then you better either have a partner that's completely aligned with you, or you should try to bootstrap it as long as possible.
It sounds like one of the more important parts of before you even go ask for a dime is like a really honest self audit of your plan and your vision.
Yeah.
Because that's if you do get someone to buy into that, that's exactly what they're going to hold you accountable for. And if you were at all dishonest in any part of it, you're fucking yourself in the long run.
Yeah. Dishonest or even just wishy-washy, right? Even if you had the intention of doing something, but you can't figure out, you haven't really thought it through. I remember there was a podcast, I don't know if it was on Short Story Long or one of the ones, but it was about the guy who started Stance Socks. I don't know if it's true or not, but basically that guy apparently had thought through everything from the first pair of socks he was going to sell until $1 billion in sales. He had kind of mapped out who he was going to sell it to, how much, when, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I think he was an investment banker or something. So he was in a position where he'd seen a lot of things, had the time to do research because he was already successful and naturally was, I guess, whatever, into the details. But from the story at least, he had it so mapped out. And then along the way, he would show everyone that and say, hey, here's my plan. He'd raise money and the whole plan, you know, not only the first step, but like all these steps along the way were always visible to investors, and he would adjust it as needed in the future. But apparently he would just nail every goal. And so investors thinking, wow, this guy's, he's mapped out this plan, which seems ambitious to sell socks and turn socks into such a big company. But he told us the first three goals when we invested based on the first goal, and he's hit all of them. So, you know, there was like a track record.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like, well, these guys invested and I told them we're going to do $5 million. When the investors are sitting there going, what the fuck are you talking about? You told me you're going to do $10 million. This is all revisionist history to make the story sound good. This was like, hey, all out in the open. I'm totally confident. When I heard it, I was like wondering, was there some revisionist history here? And also was like, man, I wish that would be awesome to have such a clear vision. And really, the difference was he wasn't in a rush to start. Mm-hmm. He was in a rush to have a really well thought out plan. And so I took that as a lesson of like, okay, sometimes, and now I'm not saying that I did anything based on that lesson yeah. or changed any behavior.
I learned my lesson, but man.
But if I was writing a wish list for myself, it would be
right in the top.
Hey, maybe sometimes instead of ready, fire, aim, it should be like, really think like, how cool would it be to think all the steps through in advance and have something to just cross-reference all the time and be like, yep, still on pace. Not only that, be confident enough to show everyone these detailed plans and then just see this groundswell of like confidence in you as everyone's like, wow, this dude said he was going to do this, this, and this. He's done this, this, and this. And then people willing to take bigger and bigger risks and bigger bets on him. It was pretty cool.
So that's one way to get capital.
That's one way to get capital. Think of every fucking plan. <kid. laughs> But there is no right way. There is no one path. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. And not everyone has access to the same conversations or money or, you know, some people it's like, why even bother doing it? I could raise, you know, $1 million with one call, but I don't want to do it. And there's other people that are like, dude, raising $10,000 seems about as impossible as raising $1 billion right now. And the reality is, in both situations, all you can do is, you know, research, you know, keep building up and thinking about your plan and just whatever one step forward is, right? Like, even your first valuation, like, what's better? Saying no to all the investors because you didn't want to give up that much of your company and then not having that company, or giving up a little more than you thought but getting some great investors? And even then, there's no right or wrong answer, because you might pass on getting investors because they want too much of your company. They're not understanding the vision clear enough to, or you don't have enough experience, or whatever they're saying is why they need more of the company. It still might be the right thing to say, well, then I'd rather not even have a company, because if I have a company like that, I'm going to be stuck in a situation that I'm going to resent. That could be the case. Or it could be you take the money, you give up too much of the company, and someone's like, I can't believe you gave up half your company for $500. And it's like, dude, I had no other way to get started, and I'd rather have half of something than all of nothing.
Yeah.
So it really is just, you know, whatever you have access to.
And what you prefer.
What you prefer. And the only thing you can really control is how much time you've spent understanding your business you're about to get into, how thorough your plan is, how well you can talk about it, and how much time you've spent to understand what's in it for them, and then try to get to a happy point where everyone sacrifices and everyone's happy.
We need like a Nick Tank episode.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Where like,
oh please,
where Dennis presents
Crooks and Goons. PowerPoint. I'll get the suit.
Glad it's that one and not his other idea.
Oh, that one. Yeah. Just wait till I finish.
Lord. If Dennis comes in a t-shirt made out of $100 bills, then we will absolutely do
hand
that.
Hand sewn.
And that might even get us. That might even get us our own URL on YouTube at that point.
If we could get that to pull up. Yeah.
So. Life savings. I'm wearing it.
How many bills did
you I? You can call it, yeah, like paperclip, paperclips of bills.
Well, that wraps up episode number
nine
of The Startup Addict. And
we're on to double digits. There's no stopping us now.
Yeah, now it's all uphill from here after this one.
Next time you hear from us, we will be in the tens.
Yes, and hopefully a YouTube channel.
Damn it. Yeah, hopefully we'll have a URL at some point.
That'd be sweet.
So, all right, cool. Well, thanks for listening. Again, any questions, comments, feel free to hit us up on in the comments on our Instagram, or which is at the Startup Addict, Twitter, startup_addict, on iTunes. You can just search for the Startup Addict. Thanks to everyone subscribed. I think we've been doing great in the rankings, but we can always go higher.
Let's keep going. Let's keep climbing, baby.
And our YouTube supporters that we know are out there somewhere.
They're just handshaking over the mouse, wanting to click on
it. We are so excited for you to give us allow us just to get our custom push URL it at some point.
Click on that button. Get $100,000.
You can do it.
So, all right. Capital closed.
Done.